Honeywood Reel 2. Now, the Motorcycle Machine Gun Service, which you joined at Bisley in January of 1915, was a new service, later became the Machine Gun Corps. But when you joined it, how well equipped and established was it at Bisley?
It had only just started. I think, as far as I can remember, it started in about November 1914. And by January 15, of course, they'd got it going fairly well. But even then, none of the batteries had gone out to France. They started going at the end of December.
It would obviously have drawn its personnel from a great variety of regiments.
Oh, yes, and from motorcyclists all over the country, you see, and motor engineers. For instance, one man I know, he's dead now, I gather, was Gray from Guildford, who the garage people at Guildford, he owned a big garage there. And he was a captain when I got there, commissioned direct, because he knew all about motorbikes and things like that.
So was it in character very much a technically orientated kind of unit?
Yes, to a point. But of course the main thing was to learn the machine gun work.
What was actually at Bisley as the establishment of the Motorcycle Machine Gun Service when you arrived there?
There was the headquarters, and as far as I can remember, there were seven batteries in formation. I can't remember the actual establishment of what the batteries were, how many guns each officer had, I don't know. But I remember there was a major in command and three subalterns, each of whom had a section of guns. Guns were very short at the time. In fact, we had to share. The gun in question, of course, was the Vickers water-cooled gun. And it was in short supply. I mean, we weren't equipped until we were just going out to France. We weren't equipped with it, with our complete numbers.
Were there many people like yourself who were motorcycle enthusiasts?
Oh, yes.
Some years?
Lots of them.
That must have established some sort of competitive camaraderie,
oh, yes.
I imagine.
Oh, yes, and it helped in friendships, too. One knew a lot of them.
Was there, in fact, any element of sort of competitive camaraderie between the motorcycle enthusiasts who joined this organization?
Oh, no, there wasn't a chance.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if we could do a sort of step-by-step breakdown of how the Motorcycle Machine Gun Service was organized at this time. You know, starting from the smallest unit, there would be a bike with a sidecar unit carrying a gun. That was the sort of the basic operational unit. Could you develop it from there?
Yes, as I say, I can't remember how many guns we had to a battery, but the units were batteries because we were then gunners. There was no badge or anything for machine gun service. We were actually commissioned to gunners. The motorcycles, the machine guns were carried on Kleino motorcycles. That is, no sidecar, but a framework with a bicycle saddle, which the gunner sat on to carry the gun, the Kleino motorbike to propel it. And then there were extra Kleino carriers, gun carriers, ammunition carriers to come on behind as well. The officers were mounted on Douglas 2.5 horsepower. I don't think I can remember much else about it.
What What sort of how was the unit structure of the service built up? I mean, what was the next unit above one motorcycle and one sidecar?
Units were sections. As far as I can remember, there were three sections to a battery, but I can't remember how many guns each section had. I think it was four.
So there'd be four motorcycles in a section?
No, because you've got your motorcycles carrying the ammunition as well.
Okay, tell me about a section then, and what was its
establishment? A section would have however many guns it was. As I say, I can't remember. And then to each of those guns there'd be another motorcycle with ammunition. And as well as that, other motorcycles with the men who were going to do the repairs and all that kind of thing, and all their equipment.
Now, how was the training organized at Bisley? So you had these sections and batteries. What kind of training was carried out?
Well, mostly, of course, it was training with the gun itself, with the Vickers machine gun. And there we did ordinary firing on the range, etc. But then we also did firing as a battery, coming up on the range and doing it tactically. Though, as far as I can see, it was never used, never happened in actual warfare.
When you say coming up on the range and doing it tactically, what do you mean by that exactly?
I mean bringing a battery up.
Now, you mentioned the tactical training you were given on the
ranges.
Oh,
yes, coming and bringing the whole battery, for instance, up onto a range and firing from with the gun mounted on the sidecar frame. That was all practiced, but that was never used in war.
Was there any kind of training that sort of developed the mobility of the machine gun units?
No, the mobility was merely used to get from one place to another. And then, I mean, every single battery, as far as I know, was just shoved into the trenches. Mm. We were made brigade troops, so many guns allotted to each brigade.
And the motorcycles then became
motorcycles
a bit redundant.
Really, well, mm. They were just left behind somewhere where we could pick them up to move somewhere else.
Yeah. Now, as far as the training at Bisley was concerned, was that how the role of the motorcycle machine gun service was explained to you?
I don't quite follow that.
Well, you said that you were just allocated to the infantry battalions as machine gunners, but I wondered whether during training it was conceived that the motorcycle machine gun service had a role which would in fact exploit its mobility.
We thought, when we went out, I mean, we thought, of course, we should be able to use the guns as, well, rather like mounted infantry. But not a bit of it, no. We very soon learnt that we'd got to be allotted to the trenches.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the spring of 1915, you went across to France. Did you go across as a unit?
Yes, we went over on the 7th of April, 15, landed at Havre, went straight up to Bayeul, where GHQ was. Incidentally, Douglas Haig was commanding, and he was the commander of my regiment, colonel-in-chief of my regiment, mm-hmm. So I knew him.
Did you ever have any personal contact with
him? Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. And especially after the war, of course, but I saw him once or twice during the war.
What sort of impression did he make on you?
Very dour and brilliant.
Can you illustrate those conclusions with any of the
Not really.
Things
I
that
mean,
happened?
No, I don't think I could. Wouldn't like to say with somebody like that.
Okay. So your base was at Bayeul?
No, we got to Bayeul, and then we were sent straight up to Poperinghe, and within 2 days. We were in the trenches.
Where?
Personally, my own section, we were close to a place called Boesinghe, Boesinghe.
Tell me what it was like at Boesinghe when you got there.
Well, there were deep trenches, full of water. Had to stand up on steps to get to look over the top of the trenches at all. Bodies cut off in the parapet. Arms sticking out and things like that. Most repulsive in actual fact.
Did your first experience of trench conditions come as a surprise? Any features of them which you hadn't expected?
I don't suppose it was a surprise, no. But it's a rather a thought of horror at what one did see. But one very quickly got used to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, the first major operation you were involved in was the Second Battle of Ypres.
Second Battle of Ypres.
Tell me about your experiences during that battle.
Well, my experiences really are not much, because I was sitting in the trenches the whole time. It was in the days when the German used to come over in bulk, and they came over in waves. Soon as one was shot down by a machine gun or anything, another wave came along. We were kicked out of our trenches once or twice, but I don't think there's much really. It's just ordinary trench warfare. There's not much one can say about it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there was a certain amount of work done on night patrols and getting out listening posts, trying to find out what was happening on the other side, because in many places, well, at Boesinghe, for one, the trenches were only, a German trench and British trenches were only about 80 yards apart.
Do you remember any particular patrols that you went out on?
Oh, I just remember going out with, taking them out into a shell hole and listening and that kind of thing, but nothing very much.
Mm.
I was never in any really great battle.
You were, though, on the receiving end of the first gas attack.
We just got a whiff of it. That was when the gas attack took place at Hooge, H-W-G-E.
Mm-hmm.
We just got a whiff of it. And of course, in those days, that might be interesting. The gas mask consisted merely of a piece of gauze, a piece of cotton wool soaked in hydrochloric, what is it you use for fixing photographs? I can't remember the word for it.
Mm.
Anyhow, you held that in your mouth, and you had a clip that went over your nose, and that's all there was. But we luckily didn't get it badly. The French got it and ran away, French gunners. And they were, the gap was stopped by Princess Pat's own Canadian regiment.
Mm.
That was at Hooge.
Mm. Now, I think that in the rear areas, when you're out of the front line, there was some opportunities for relaxation, and I think that you told me before that you had some interesting experiences of rather makeshift bathing arrangements at Popperinge.
Well, the only bath that I was ever able to get out there was at Popperinge. We were pretty lousy by then and very dirty. And we went to the baths at Popperinge, which were in a brewery. The vats were used. There were so many vats told off for men and so many for officers. And there were two girls there, Mimi and Fifi, who used to come round. You took your clothes off, stark naked, handed them over to one of these girls who took them off to be cooked. You had your bath. And then she came back and gave you your clothes again when you were drying yourself. Actually, I met Mimi again in 1940 during the Second World War in France. She was still alive and her sister was dead.
You left France in July 1915, but...
In September it was.
Was it? Ah. Now, in that six-month period on the Western Front, what features of life or of conditions there are the ones which you remember most vividly for any reason?
Oh, I think the... What the troops would call the matiness, the mixture of officer and man, which in the trenches, well, I mean, you were one. Mm. And the loyalty of the men to their officers, of course, was extraordinary. For that reason, I think, because everybody mucked in together.
Do you have any particular examples in mind of this kind of camaraderie?
I wouldn't say that I'd got anything special, not that I can think of at the moment. Mm.
Did you find yourself well prepared and well equipped for the kind of operations and activities you were involved in while you were?
No, but one learnt it very quickly. I mean, all one had got to do was to stick it out and to get up and shoot.
Can you be a bit more specific? Well, what kind of things weren't you well prepared or equipped for, and what kind of things did
well,
you...
Well, I mean, I don't think we expected to be in water up to our knees and that kind of thing. Or the mud, the rats.
These were persistent conditions, were they?
Oh, yes.
Day in, day out, week
day
in, week
out. Day in, day out. Even when there was no rain, I mean, you never got the water out of the trenches.
Yeah. Were there any ways or any steps you could take to help you adapt yourself to these kind of difficulties?